Thank you very much, and thank you very much for the invitation to the organizers to come here and participate in this exciting event. I think I'm sort of a bit, I really came to learn, and I had sort of this decision that I, with myself, should I really try to learn something new? And I realized that maybe this was, yeah, I probably should. So I'm coming here to learn. I have been seen a bit of this here and there, and as people would have seen from the Slack. In 1993, I was examining a dissertation in Denmark by Peter Harmos on conditional independence and time, where he actually showed that gave a graphical model formulation of the Bell inequality problem and had a chapter on quantum physics. And at that time, I sort of said, one day I will return to this, and that one day might be this week. On the other hand, then there is the issue is that when I should prepare my talk, this is an audience I don't know, so the question is, how should I pitch it in this audience? And I just, I'm just sorry, this might be completely off what you really expect, but I'm going to give a survey of issues of graphical models, which are very much from my own perspective, and I've been involved, of course, in this since 1976, when I gave my first lecture on graphical models in Adelaide. Not in Adelaide, in Canberra in Australia, actually. So that's quite a number of years. First, I would just say what was sort of the precursors that brought graphical models there, and how did they get there? And how did the graphical models then suddenly appear? And then I will show you some more modern examples of what they're used for, very, very briefly. Some of it you might know, some of it you might not know. Then a little bit about some important milestones that I think of where things happened that really moved the subject quite a lot. And a few things about more recent developments. So here is the origin as I more or less know it, one of the origins. This is from physics. So this is again an interesting thing. This was statistical physics. This was the Lenz or Ising model to describe ferromagnetism. And there were sort of little graphs like this. And the idea was that the energy of a system was a function of the spins at the various sites that either could be plus or minus, and it was sort of a function of this form. And then the probability of a state should be a proportional, it's a Gibbs state, proportional to minus the energy, exponent of minus the energy divided by a constant times the absolute temperature. And this was, I knew a little about this at an early stage where I sort of came across it for various reasons. The other origin is that I know of is from genetics, which is quite different. This is probably one of the first graphical models. And what you see there is a genetic model which is trying how the characteristics of two individuals and their children, how they actually are transmitted genetically through the genetic mechanism. And this is from Sewell Wright from 1921. And it's a nice little diagram with where the observable variables are these little animals where you can see the characteristics. There was also a more mathematical version of this. This was, which essentially discovered path analysis and path diagrams, and which we now think of as being the basic causal model for various ways. And that was published in 1934 in the Annals of Mathematical Statistics. Then there was something else, which was a classic statistical theory, which is what I really knew about because this was at some point hot in the department where I was studying at the time when I was a student. So this was log linear models, as described Leo Goodman and his student Haberman, who was who was writing his thesis at the Chicago University. And they also worked about interactions and classified them in these various ways without doing any graphs or any pictures. And Terry Speed and I set aside, made a seminar we had in Perth in 1976, where Terry invited me down under. And we met every day at 2 o'clock and had a 1 hour seminar. And then we won 2 hour seminar maybe, then worked like idiots overnight and worked again, met again at 2 o'clock. And three poor students were forced to listen to us while we were talking. And we sort of discovered, we tried to figure out whether there was any relationship between what they talked about in physics and genetics and this contingency table stuff. And of course, graphical models appeared when we realized that it was just the same thing, just the notation was different. And I guess something like that is actually happening here in this community as well. And I always find these kind of cross things quite exciting. So here are some more modern ones where you use genetics, and one should think of them as a bit more sophisticated than it looks like here. Again, it's a genetic diagram like that of Sewell Wright, but now every little blob is actually a graphical model itself. And inside that graphical model, there are blobs that are graphical models. So it's sort of a hierarchy of graphical models that are. So it looks simple, but it's much more complicated than it is like that. Here is a big genetic pedigree, which are Eskimos, which has been analyzed by graphical model methods, which is families of Eskimos in Greenland. And these are the parental relations between them, and therefore you could study transmission of various types of diseases. In forensic genetics, you have similar things like that. Medical diagnosis, this was one of the breakthroughs in the graphical model theory. This particular diagram has sometimes been called a real-life application. It isn't. It's completely fake, and it's made up by David Spiegelhalter and me. And we know it's fake because we faked it. But we wrote it was fictitious in the paper, but it has been cited many, many times as a real-life application. That's just nonsense. I did the diagram, and David did the story associated with it. Then there is the one of the early one of the early Bayesian networks trying to understand what happened in the neuromuscular systems of muscles that do this and do this with the thumb and do this with the little finger. And this is sort of the nervous system. The idea was that if you made measurements here and there in the system, then you could diagnose what was wrong. For example, maybe the nerve had got squeezed up there. So this is another application. And here's a financial application. This is more bit exploratory, just finding out was various types of assets, how their prices are related on the stock market. And there are many other applications. It used to be a very small group of people when we met with graphical models, sort of like 10. This is not the way it is now. I think you have several million hits if you Google graphical models. And you have in one of the applications is digital communication. I think actually somebody here from Waterloo. Insurance fraud, it's used in. It's used for credit evaluation. It's used to for intelligent cars so they can interpret scenes of what they see. It's used in various types of space technology. Game theory, and both theoretical games and actual games. Microsoft is using that with a lot of actual games, and game theory has also been used with that. Image analysis of various types. Quantum systems, I put a question mark there. It's just because I don't know much about how it's applied in quantum systems. But that's what I expect to learn. I know it's there, and I know some of the people in the audience have written papers, and I've seen some of them, and I will try to learn. And you name it. It has become, from being a very small thing, it has become quite a common endeavor here and there. And I think you can go on with finding applications of graphical models. It has really become a big thing from being a very small thing. Now, how did that all happen? Well, as I said first, the very first thing was my visit to Terry Speed, the very first thing of the modern development, of course. There was Hermann Wald in econometrics. There was the Sewell Wright. There was the easing model, as I told you before. But somehow people didn't realize it was the same thing. They were all sort of separate things that they thought they were separate things. But when Terry and I had the seminar in Australia in 1986, it was quite clear to us that apart from notation, it was exactly the same thing. So this is where it started for me, and it was definitely, and I think I gave my first seminar after I had been in Perth for about 2 months. I gave a seminar in Canberra. And I think this is my first thing. That's 1976, so that's quite a while ago. Then I came participated in the Swedish summer school in. Where I met Nanny Wermut, who is also working on graphical models. And she was working with directed models, whereas what I did with Terry originally was only undirected graphical models. So Terry, I think what happened was that he randomly read an article in Biometrics, which he just he read it for good night reading. He had just sort of joined Biometric Society and got this stack of things, and there was this paper by Nanny saying that where she actually did graphical models with DAGs, and realizing that it was sort of the same thing, whether it was Gaussian or non-Gaussian, and I worked over a period of 10 years with Nanny to make an extension to more complicated graphs, chain graphs, and discrete continuous variables. Then became a bit of a community, but then what really made it move was the fact that you could solve the computational problems for sparse DAGs in artificial intelligence, and this was partly my paper with David Spiegelhalter and partly the book by Judea Pearl, 1988. It sort of all ended up being published in the same years, and a lot of people sort of came to that particular thing at the same time. I believe ours was giving the sort of full story, but it was something very quick, and that really made it popular because suddenly people were started talking about it. And then finally, the Markov chain Monte Carlo methods, where you could do the computations with Markov chain Monte Carlo. Again, this was something physicists had been doing for a long, long time on easing models and that type of models on particle systems. And the point is that the Markov chain Monte Carlo method, which was discovered by the statisticians in about 1992, maybe 1990, if you should say, the paper by, is that actually these methods could be used in much more general terms. Because all these things were the same thing, you could then use the same method. So methods that were well known from physics were translated into statistics and solved a lot of statistical problems. So that was sort of, now I'm going the wrong way. So that was sort of, in a certain sense, a long list of things that suddenly made it much more mainstream and suddenly made it more interesting. But now it really moved. Pearl and Milan Studeni in particular developed the abstract theory for conditional independence, and which you may or may not know some of. I will just do a little bit of it in a bit. And also, they started the causal interpretation. I should say, when Pearl wrote his book in 1988, and when Pearl was studying this, He was just not doing anything causal. He said, causal is a computational device and it's not relevant for anything else, and it's something, and I know because I'm a physicist, he said, because he is originally educated in superconductors. That's his area. So, a causal was just a computational device, it was not interesting. Somehow in about 1992, 1993, he got a conversion and suddenly everything was causal. And this really created a huge interpretation everywhere. Yeah.
The other Peter Surtees and Clark Bleemore, do you know how they became interested in graphical model? Was it from a physics angle or?
No. This was from the, this was the causal theory of the DAGs, and this was definitely causal. Actually, they first wrote, that was, I think, that was Clark Bleemore and I think Thomas is in the audience. He can correct me because he is a student from there. But the first thing, they came out a book called Causal Discovery, which was from 1987, which was using tetrad and only correlations of the multivariate, essentially working on the multivariate normal and just looking at correlation patterns. And that was identifying causal structure by empirical evidence. And when that came out, this was, this was made by computer scientists and philosophers, and it came out with the statistical techniques that they used were, to put it mildly, naive, and did not take into account the fact that you had random noise, et cetera, et cetera. But they had the algorithms that sort of discovered the PC algorithm is for example, et cetera. Originally, the 87 was not the PC algorithm. Then they wrote a book. This one, 1993, came a bit later. I think their paper is from 1992. But they had all the, they had the formalism about causal interpretation of DAGs being by you had a DAG and you had the manipulated DAG, where the one you actually, you changed and you took the arrows away and did all that stuff. And I, and I'm sure Pearl was inspired by that, because it's sort of about the same time. But the 87 book was really getting extremely unpopular in some statistical circles, and in particular David Friedman in Berkeley and others gave a crusade against these terrible people that that somehow could have the ridiculous idea that you could discover causal structure from experiments. Because causal structure you can only discover from insight, and that was the only way you could discover causal structure. And that, and that was, and it took quite a while where Peter Spertus and others, when they were taking around, they were hammered in all sorts of conferences and audience as being ridiculous. And it really took Judea's personality to break through and sort of make it acceptable in statistical circles. And I think the Pearl 1995 paper, causal analysis, empirical diagrams for causal analysis, empirical diagrams for causal analysis, something where he does a Duke calculus in Biometrica, which was courageously published by the then editor Philip David. That really sort of was the first to make a bridge between these apparently completely opposed cultures. Statisticians are generally very conservative. They don't like people coming into their turf and doing something original that they have not done, seen before. Anyway, that was a bit. Then suddenly you get a lot of graph types. Time is running. This is because I answer questions. I hope I will speed up at some point. But the if you keep asking me for anecdotes, I can deliver them by the hour, right? Okay. So suddenly you have a lot of other graph types involved in independence. Nanny and I did these chain graphs, but there were all sorts of other graphs, in particular graphs for that you obtain by latent variables, determined by latent marginalization and conditioning, which were Richardson and Spertus. Suddenly variational inference. Again, there was, now we had this Markov chain Monte Carlo, we had these exact computations, and then also, but then variational inference came into the picture. And that was mean field theory, again taken from physics. It was, again, a well-developed thing that was well-studied or standard in physics that was now translated to a more general setting. In particular, Michael Jordan was involved in that translation. And then you had all these methods for structure identification. I'm sure some of them were, of course, sold as causal discovery, but some of them had nothing to do with causal. It was just a question of discovering graphical structure, etc. And they were several types of methods for that. Okay. And the basis for all of it is a notion of conditional independence, and that for probabilities, it can be factorized in terms of a probability factorization like that. So it's essentially a factorization of this type. And you could do it, but I don't do it here, but from the previous talk, and as is shown also in Milan Studnik's book, you can also use entropy inequalities and equalities this gives you an equivalent formulation for conditional independence. And essentially, for undirected graphs, you have this idea that if you have separation in the graph, then you have conditional independence. And there are examples of that. I'll do this quickly. For directed DAGs, it's more complicated. You have a different separation criterion known as deseparation. But the basic basic structure behind that defines a directed graphical model is that any node is conditional independent of its predecessors, if you like, given its intermediate parents. And you have bidirected graphs where you have a separation that every path passes through the complement of the nodes. And for Gaussian distribution, this corresponds to covariances being equal to zero, whereas the standard Markov theory corresponds to inverse elements, the inverse covariance being equal to zero. And essentially random variables, they satisfy these four conditions for conditional independence. And this is what the theory of graphical models is really based on, exploiting these four conditions. Sometimes, if you have strictly positive densities, you have a stronger condition, which is known as which is this one that you can sort of, what you can do here is that you can take something. You have the conditioning set is big, and you can make it smaller. And because if something in common is that W, then you can put that up here. This is not universally true.
So sorry. The condition here was that it's strictly positive and not zero. What, this blue condition?
Yeah.
Okay.
Strict positivity implies it.
Okay. Okay.
It's not necessary. There is a necessary condition for when this holds, but it's it really needs that support has to satisfy. It has to be sort of a connected set in a certain graph. So that, but the positivity implies it, and the similar one now is which has been used for the abstract theory, which is the one that has been exploited by. Developed by Judea Pearl and Milan Studnik and others, is that the. Is that you have these semigraphoid conditions, which are the first conditions applied to the specific case where X, Y, Z, and W are marginals of the original variables. So these are sets. And if they call it the semigraphoid, if the first four of them, I think in the original paper by Pearl, he calls the first thing a graphoid. And if the fifth thing comes in, then I've seen in some of the literature, I think in quantum, where I've seen they call it a graphoid and a positive graphoid, but it's a semigraphoid and graphoid. The point is that another thing which is quite common is that this composition also holds. This holds for graphs, that it's a compositional graphoid. So there's also a sixth one. And actually, you can see in some of the proofs of the various equivalences of Markov in Pearl's book in 1988, he thinks this is always all fulfilled. But it isn't. This is an extra condition. But it's certainly fulfilled for the Gaussian case. And I think the real graphical models should have all six of these because all these six are hold for things that actually look like graphs. I mean, the idea is that the graph should somehow capture the independence things you get. And then you have separation undirected graphs is an example of a compositional graphoid. So in that, therefore, systems of random variables will satisfy only the four of them. If it's positive, it satisfies the fifth of them. If it's Gaussian, it satisfies the compositional one. Otherwise, it's not necessarily so. So there's a general Markov theory where you have this a different type of separation. I could call it G-separated. For DAGs, it becomes D-separated. But there's quite an abstract way of saying which parts are actually separating and which are not separating. And in principle, and you have this, it's Markov. If any time you have separation in the graph, you have conditional independence. It's faithful if it's the other way around. And these are sort of standard things. And given that what we have heard already, I believe I don't have to repeat that. I was just saying it is there, and I guess my overheads will be somehow available. So in principle, I could draw a graph like that. And my G separation actually gives sense to this, and it will always give me a compositional graphoid. So it will give it, the separation itself will give me a compositional graphoid. The question is, are there any probability distribution that fits with that? And I guess this is still not known when that is true and when that is not true. It's known for certain types, you know it's true. And right. It's not universally true. Oops, here I go again. Yeah.
How is it not achievable if all of the root variables are binary and each other variable just is a composite variable which includes?
Well, it's because the thing is the faithfulness. I mean, you can have some of the things because this gives you a list of independences that should be fulfilled. And a list of independences that should be not violated.
Yeah.
And the question is, can you find a probability measure that does one and that?
Yeah, so if each variable expresses all of its parents.
Well, if you have these double arrows and you have these weird things, and it's simply, and the question is, how does it make, because this thing about expressing things in terms of their parents is something that is special for DAGs.
Cyclic
graphs. They're cyclic and they're all sorts of things. And they are bidirected edges and they are, and it's not, some of them, which, those that look like this and that actually come from marginalizing and conditioning in DAGs, these are the maximal ancestral graphs that are described by Richardson and Spertus. For these, there are faithful distributions. But the question is, when, for which other ones are there? And this is simply not known.
What did the undirected edges mean?
Well, this is, since at the moment it doesn't mean anything, it's just, it defines an independence relation, right? But the question is, does there exist a faithful P? Could exactly say what this. If you have a faithful P, you could say what it means, right? But the question, does it make sense at all? And this is another way of saying that. Although it's a formally makes sense as an independent as an abstract independent model, is there anything that follows such a model? You can say this is the question that I have. Anyway, I would.
Could I also ask something?
Yeah.
So you also have.
You should.
So you have kind of two. Well, you have different type of edges.
Yeah.
You know, the bi-directed ones.
We have three types of edge. Yeah.
Exactly. Ones that are just connections.
Yeah.
So what is the? How do I think of these?
Yeah. This is the point. Is you by. By that question, you mean, how do I explain that in terms of a DAG or something that I know better, right?
So
and the answer is, you don't.
Okay, so I just have three.
Because,
five.
You know, some systems might be more complicated than DAGs. And one of the things I've actually been wondering about is a bit, some of these quantum systems, you know, they feature issues that you cannot describe well by DAGs properly. I'm surprised. Yeah.
I mean, if I may add to that, Perlin, 1988, he does suggest these undirected
He has
selection nodes, right? So
yeah.
You can think about selection nodes.
Well, in Richardson and Spertus formalism, then you would have that each of an undirected edge is a restraint which is obtained by observing a consequence. Each bidirected edge is because there's a latent variable that points to them. But that cannot give this graph. Okay?
Why?
Well, there is a characterization about which graphs it can give or which graph it cannot give. And this is completely solved in Richardson and Sperta's paper, where they know exactly what can you get by conditioning and marginalizing. And you can get graphs with three types of edge, that's fine, but not all graphs with three types of edge.
Okay, you're talking about mags, right?
So I'm just saying, given me what are the graphs with three types of edge that can be faithfully represent, that can be faithfully represented by a probability measure. And maybe it's only the mags, which, or the ancestral graphs, which the Richardson and Asperger's talk about. Maybe that's the only ones. I don't know.
Well,
it's certainly not the only ones, because if you marginalize and condition in chain graphs, you get something else. The chain graphs cannot be, but they do make sense, but they cannot be emulated in this way. So there are certain graphs that are not. Anyway, so, but this gives you, So this gives you a way of how to define what the graph means in terms of conditional independence. The question is there any probabilistic or other object, even in quantum, whatever, that has such a structure? I have no idea. In general, I have no idea. Okay. So I will just finish by just showing that sometimes you have things get more complicated, even if you don't do quantum. So here is a class of models which should describe the structure and dependent structure of extreme events. So essentially, any variable is a linear function, if you like, of its parents. But the linear function is maximum rather than sum. So instead of a plus, you take max, right? And you can write that in an algebraic way, is exactly so you get equations that look like the standard linear equation. But the product that you should take is this sort of product. You multiply in the matrices, and instead of summing over k, you max over k. And these correspond to systems. Say you have a network, a river network, and you have some extreme rainfalls here and there. How does the rainfall spread in the network? That would be an example of a structure that satisfies this property. And then there is some mathematics about it. But what I just wanted to show, and to study that, you can use tropical linear algebra. And I'm referring to a paper from 2022. And the point is, the reason that I put it up here is that you get something different from deseparation. It's just not faithful to deseparation. It's not faithful to these tags. And here's an example. Suppose you have a structure like that, and just say that the fourth variable, number four, is a maximum of 1 and 2. Number five is a maximum of 2 and 3. And that's all you know. And it's continuous variables. So what you have, this structure says that the largest of 1 and 2 has to be smaller than x4. The largest of 2 and 3 has to be smaller than x5. So this is essentially 4 is the maximum of these two, 5 is the maximum of these two. And the point is, and here I have it again, so you can now see, what does that mean? Suppose now you see x4 and x5. So these are observed, whereas the other three are latent. Now, if x4 is less than x5, then these constraints separate out in two different constraints. One is saying that x1 and x2 has to be smaller than x4, and x3 has to be smaller than x5. Because this thing, since x2 is already smaller than x4, it's redundant to say that it's smaller than x5. So it separates out in two equations, one of them depending only on 1 and 2, the other equation only depending on 3. Similarly, if x4 is bigger than x5, you have it the other way around. The x1 only depends on the x4. The x1 is the only one that is constrained by x4, and this constraint by x5 is only constraining x2 and x3. And these are independent. And similar, if they're equal, everything must be equal. So x1 is smaller than x4, x3 is smaller than x5, and x2 must be equal to x4 and x5. And because of that, you have x1 and x3 are independent. x1 and independent. x1 and x2, x3 are independent given 4 and 5. They're not de-separated. So if you both observe x4 and x5, so if you have a path with colliders, with more than one collider, then they're not separated, because then you get independence. And that means that even in a simple case like that, you can get quite different independent structures. And this particular, so again, de-separation simply is not fulfilled for each of them. You know, I can go into detail, that takes a lot of time, but this is an example of non-standard ones, and I could assume also, and I've seen there's something called Q-separation. I think there are issues in quantum systems that also satisfy a different pattern of conditional independence, depending on how you define conditional independence. Okay, that was all, and I have the literature, the references, and I guess the overheads will somehow be available somewhere, right? Anyway. So I know this was a bit quick, but yeah, I even took a bit more time than I should. Thank you. That's because of your question. That's because of your questions.
I have a question. Yeah. So in this last example, you said that 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 are continuous variables.
Yeah.
So, but you would still get similar constraints, right? If you restrict them to be discrete, or even like discrete and...
Well, the point is that if you're discrete, you get a slightly different, then de-separation actually works if they're discrete.
Okay.
So it's because of the continuity, this is because of, so you can say it's because of some idealization. So it's really the... it's this last condition here.
Okay.
That if they are equal, it's because they, the only way that, because if they're continuous variables, the only way x4 and x5 can be equal is because they're equal to x2. And this is because this one is the largest. And this means that having x4 and x5 equal means you actually also know what x2 is. And this means that actually you know what all three variables are, and therefore 1 and 3 are independent. So this is an example. But there's a paper with reference to that, and that's a long paper, but we have lots of many more examples where standard de-separation does not give it, and then we have, it's a bit more complicated, the condition for actually making it. So the continuity really plays a role here. If you, for this one, there are other types of non-faithfulness where continuity wouldn't change things. But this particular one has to do with the continuity. But the problem is that then the independence model for such a thing is then not, I don't think it's a compositional graphoid. And the point is that you have a path from 1, 4, 2. Suppose you observe 4 and 5. Then 1, 4, 2 is an open path, de-separation wise. And 2, 5, 3 is also an open path, de-separation. But the concatenation of the two paths is not. Okay? And this, many of the proofs that de-separation works is because you take one path and you take another path and then you combine them and then you get a path again, an active path again. But this doesn't hold for this one. And this means, and this makes it weird. And I'm sure that there are quantum structures that are quite different than their conditional independence structure. I don't know why I'm sure. I would just be surprised that because it's a different universe, right? So one should expect to see things that are quite different.
So on the Slack channel, Ilya mentioned that graphs of just bi-directed edges can have conditional independence relations that don't correspond to any DAG. For example, like the square where you have four observed guys and bi-directed edges between them, where the ones on the diagonal are independent, and there's no DAG that has that pattern of conditional dependencies. Do we have an understanding of all the examples like that? Do we have any sort of general theory of?
We don't have an example. We don't have a general theory of the counterexample, but there's a general theory of the examples. All conditional independent structures that can be described by conditioning and marginalization in DAGs, or if you like, all those that can be by marginalization only. They're completely in the Richardson and Spurthus paper. That's completely cleared up. So that's a nice and clean story, and that, so if you insist that DAGs is sort of the primitive, to me DAGs are too primitive. I think something like the Ising model and the Lenz-Ising model, which is a reasonably well understood model by physicists, cannot be described by DAGs in any way. Right. And it's still an interesting model that describes something. Every time you have equilibrium things with restrictions and things that have to be in balance, etc., which is quite a common way of making models in certain areas, in particular physics, the DAGs are not sort of the... DAGs is a very special, simple case. And I usually have my stand. I know Thomas is in the online auditorium. But I've had long discussions with Thomas about this. We have a paper in the Journal of Royal Statistical Society where we describe which chain graphs are described by DAGs and which are not.
So you mentioned that Thomas is in the online. Here he wrote that there's a reference by even him that gives a feedback interpretation of undirected edges.
Yeah.
So I think maybe this answers.
There is a reference with feedback of undirected, but not necessarily in this full context. Mm-hmm. But there is, and I think even Thomas's PhD dissertation is about that, where essentially a feedback thing is sort of a when you generate is sort of a, is you just think of a feedback system and then you go to equilibrium, right? That's one way where you disentangle the, if I may use that word here, disentangle the feedback back loop into just by time slices, put them so it doesn't become cyclic, and then you go to the limit. That's one way. But I'm not sure it's the only right way. There's in our paper we have a different one, which is more like equilibrium systems. I'm not sure that's a good one either, in terms of interpretation. But I could also expect that maybe some of these quantum things could be give interesting models that are not sort of DAG based.
I think we probably have some more questions.
Professor,
I'm going to propose that we save them for lunch because we're a bit behind schedule and we got a lunch break. So let's start by thanking Stefan again.
Thank you.